From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Papua New Guinea police and military forces have deployed extra personnel to the southern highlands to quell unrest in the province. PNG's government declared a state of emergency in the province last week after supporters of a losing candidate in the regional election went on a rampage in Mendi. The mob destroyed a commercial aircraft and set fire to the local courthouse, the provincial governor's residence, and other buildings. Johnny Blades has been covering events and has the story.
Mendi has quietened down in the last day or two, according to police, with the implementation of a curfew and other provisions of the state of emergency declaration. And, you know, as we speak, police are being deployed to the region, extra police. There is about 70 mobile squad officers already there, and more are coming in as well. We understand some dozens of military PNG Defence Force troops are also being deployed to Southern Highlands.
So as part of the state of emergency provisions, Papua New Guinea's government has suspended the provincial government. This has created some more problems.
That's right. Supporters of the provincial governor, William Powie, are upset about that suspension, and they have been mobilising with high-powered weapons and threatening violence if that provincial government isn't restored, and also threatening to disrupt public assets and so forth, and generally also warning the government, the national government, not to send up troops as if they are readying for war.
Since last Thursday's unrest in Mendi, there have been attacks or blockades on the LNG project infrastructure in neighbouring Hela province, is that right?
Right next door in Hela, where the hub of the big LNG gas project is, there have been what police say are unrelated attacks on some of the project infrastructure, including vandalism against some earth-moving equipment, and also a blockade of a main road and a blockade of a main airport, which the project uses. That's because landowners over in Hela are still upset about, you know, non-payment of promised royalties, and that's an issue stretching back years, and they're very frustrated. But, you know, the fact that it's happened now, just days after this unrest in neighbouring Southern Highlands, doesn't seem to bode well.
Is there a danger that this unrest could escalate, and is it political unrest, or is it just unrest in general?
Everyone seems to be describing it as a political issue rather than a normal law and order thing. And this is why people are also saying that the leaders of all the various political factions need to get there and sort this thing out with talks, because if high-powered weapons are involved and emotions are running high, there really is a danger that it could escalate. And people are extremely worried. It's a really sensitive stage. But yeah, the fact that you have these two provinces where this anger and frustrations over things which are close is a real powder keg.
And what have the leaders of the Southern Highlands province had to say?
The leaders who are in the national government, and that includes Peter O'Neill, the Prime Minister, who is a Southern Highlands MP, held a press conference on Sunday with the provincial government, William Powie, as well as the losing candidates whose supporters went on rampage last week in Mendi, and they all basically apologised and said they would all work together to restore order. That was a press conference down in Port Moresby. I think that was probably a good sign, but lots of people have been asking for them to come up to the province. Since that meeting, Peter O'Neill has agreed to go up to his province. He has delayed a planned trip to China to do this. He will be having talks up there, and that in a sense has answered some of the criticism that had been directed to him in the wake of the unrest.
Does this unrest have an impact on other parts of the country?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, for a start, we had this huge earthquake disaster in February up in this very region, and the people who went on the rampage last week in Mendi actually destroyed and looted tons of relief supplies, which were earmarked for victims of the earthquake in this region. So it's hampering that relief effort, which is a strain on the country. Also, it looks like it may have delayed the national government's talks with the Bougainville regional government over the all-important referendum next year. And I think it also throws a spanner in the works for the country's security preparations ahead of this November's APEC Leaders Summit, despite the fact that the government says it won't have an impact. I'm sure it's something that's making a lot of people nervous.
A New Zealand academic says the Nauru government appears to be lurching towards authoritarianism, and the New Zealand government should speak out about it and what is going on there. The Nauru government has made a series of controversial moves going back 4 years, but more recently introduced draconian contempt court laws that are widely viewed as repressive and aimed to curb freedom of speech. the director of the Pacifica Center at Massey University, Malaka Kolomankambi, told Don Wiseman Nauru is heading in the wrong direction in terms of democracy.
One would have to say that Nauru is tending towards more authoritarianism, and it's been under clutch. It's been in trouble recently with the issue of the judiciary and, of course, the abandoning of the Australian dimension to that. It's had issues, of course, with freedom of speech. And so one would have to say that Nauru is heading in the wrong direction, if we can put it like that, in terms of democracy.
It's heading in the wrong direction because of the support it gets from Australia, because Australia wants to be able to dump its boat people there.
Exactly, and Australia, it too, has to sit down and think properly about this. When it weighs up its options, what is more important to it, the offloading of the boat people to Nauru, or the support for Nauru to develop its governance system so that it's able to move away from this tendency towards more authoritarianism? That's, of course, a decision that Canberra will have to make.
Yes, and of course, Australia wants to re-engage with the Pacific, and it wants to promote democracy across the region and good governance and this sort of thing. And at the same time, one of its closest friends is moving very much in the other direction.
That's right. So Nauru has to feel that its support and its engagement with Australia will not be threatened by this, because Australia needs it more than Nauru would need Australia. Because otherwise, I don't think Nauru would have the courage to do this. And so it must be trying to push Australia maybe to the limit of its tolerance. And one would think that Australia's tolerance in this matter is not limitless, and that there's a boundary beyond which Nauru cannot overstep.
The thing is, of course, I guess, given the intractable approach Australia's taken over its offshore detention centres, it's not going to move. It's not going to rock the boat here. So the onus falls on New Zealand, but New Zealand in the last couple of years has been very meek when it comes to Nauru. There has been no criticism whatsoever. They've restored their aid. But is the onus on New Zealand perhaps to speak out?
I know that New Zealand, as you quite rightly say, has been quite meek and has been somewhat mild, if you like, in its reaction. Of course, the other agency that should be involved in this is the Pacific Islands Forum, but of course the forum does not want to be involved in Nauru because this can be seen as a political issue, and it doesn't want to be involved with regards to politics. And of course, it won't involve itself unless it's invited. You know, the Piketawa Declaration and those kinds of conventions say that member countries should abide by the rule of law and good governance and transparency and accountability, very good elements of a democratic system. One would have to say that Nauru is not abiding by those values, and so something ought to be done. Now, Australia is not doing it, then I would think that New Zealand is the sort of next in line. Plus, the forum should be exploring their options about how to engage with Nauru. Look, Winston Peters might be someone who could get away with something like that. You know, he's able to make quite forceful pronouncements on the way forward for the Pacific. New Zealand is committed to this $700+ million package for the Pacific. Shane Jones, you know, has recently announced that Tonga is a failed state along with others. So why not test the waters to see how far you can go with this? The worst things could happen if you don't try to do something.
Of course, the Pacific Islands Forum Summit is coming up in Nauru in a couple of months' time, and this is going to be seen as an endorsement, isn't it?
Unfortunately, yes. So this is what I'm saying. If something has to be done, I think it's probably better to do it now rather than later, because otherwise, as you say, Nauru would think it's okay. It's doing the done thing, and it can get away from Australia. It can probably do so again with the transform. So something needs to be done right now. But before that can be done, I'm guessing, one will have to see Nauru as a crisis point in the Pacific, and so that it will justify moving on Nauru now rather than waiting for the forum leaders meeting.
Yes, that move has got to come from New Zealand.
I think so. New Zealand, and with the backing of the forum and some other agencies, such maybe the UN, you know, and so on. But it has to have a clear leader. And I think this is probably an opportunity for New Zealand to take their lead.
The World Health Organization says 39,000 people have contracted dengue fever in the Pacific region over the past 18 months. The team coordinator of health security and Communicable Diseases, Dr. Angela Menoros, told Johnny Meyer outbreaks of dengue, which is spread by mosquitoes, have been widespread, affecting many Pacific nations.
Since about the beginning of 2017, dengue serotype 2 has actually spread quite widely throughout the Pacific. But in fact, three of the serotypes of dengue are co-circulating in the Pacific at the moment. We've had over 39,000 cases of dengue reported since that time. Most of that has been dengue 2, but we have had some countries also reporting dengue type 1 and dengue type 4. So the outbreaks that we have had reported to us since 2017 have been from American Samoa, Fiji, Nauru, Palau, Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga, Vanuatu in 2017. Some of those were actually continuing since 2016. We've also heard from Wallace and Futuna, which has experienced a dengue type 1 outbreak, while French Polynesia and New Caledonia have reported both intercurrent outbreaks of serotypes 1 and 2. Niue reported serotype 2 and 4, and most recently you've heard of the dengue type 2 in Kiribati.
So have you got any idea how many people have died as a result of dengue over that period? You're talking over the past year and a half, is that right?
That's correct.
How many fatalities have there been in that time?
I don't have absolute numbers, but fortunately the number of fatalities have been relatively low. So although any fatality is obviously a tragedy for that individual and their family and community, in terms of international comparisons, for example, a dengue program and the case management of dengue is considered to be good if the case fatality rate, so that's the number of deaths per total number of cases rather, is under 1%, and certainly in the Pacific, the numbers are well and truly under 1%.
What is the World Health Organization doing to try and help Pacific governments deal with this problem? I guess it's a known issue. It's perhaps related to climate change. It does seem like quite an extended outbreak. What's been done to help people deal with this problem?
First of all, can I just say that it's actually a very complex interrelationship between the vectors, temperature, climate, and population immunity. So it's actually difficult to be able to definitively say that outbreaks of dengue are associated with climate change or climate variability. One of the most important factors in determining how big or small a dengue outbreak will be is the circulation of serotypes, because they have this ability to disappear from a population for a period of time. And so we've been seeing these large outbreaks of dengue 2 in some countries because they hadn't actually had dengue 2 circulating for over 20 years in some of these countries. This means that there is a large population of people who have not been previously exposed to dengue type 2, and therefore it can spread very rapidly in that population. When you have a situation where the population has got high immunity overall against that particular type of dengue, even if the virus is circulating, we don't see these large outbreaks. Temperature can affect the capacity of the dengue vector to carry the virus, and the density of the population of the mosquitoes in terms of breeding sites. But the bottom line is that if a population is immune because they have been previously exposed, even in the presence of the virus, it doesn't mean we'll see large outbreaks.
This week marks the 40th anniversary since Fiji first contributed to troops to the United Nations peacekeeping forces. Since the first 500 servicemen were deployed to Lebanon in 1978, the country has continued in the program, providing more UN peacekeepers than any other nation on a per capita basis. Fiji has benefited from the increased international profile and the significant peacekeeper salaries. But what is the impact on Fijian society? Dominic Godfrey takes a look.
In an election year in Fiji, the country is looking at two leadership options, both former military strongmen. Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama maintains a strong connection with the military and is a proponent of continued UN peacekeeping. However, his competitor Sitiveni Rambuka sees a changing role at home.
We'd like to maintain our profile in peacekeeping in the international scene, but more in our assistance for development at home. Not so much as a military force, but as a construction and development arm of government.
Mr. Rambuka says the military would no longer have any prominent role in the maintenance of law and order with him at the helm, and says they'd be answerable to the minister and cabinet. A former Member of Parliament, Roko Tupon Draunendalo, says the military's role is pervasive and harmful throughout Fiji society. She says, beyond the foreign investment lost through Fiji's militarism and coup culture, the function of government is compromised.
When the military takes over, their people, or people that they choose, take over in the civil service, permeate the civil service at senior levels, and because they are not going to do that job, their incompetence is now showing, or has been showing, its ugly head for years.
Roko Tupo says the military also gets unwarranted educational opportunities. But the military's chief of staff, Brigadier General Johnny Kaloniwai, disagrees, saying the skills they acquire are useful later to the Fiji civil service.
They have that experience, they have that qualification to work within that particular environment. I think it's just a matter of how they contribute towards that particular environment. Within the military, as in all militaries, there's a more direct approach in terms of how they do their work, their responsibilities in terms of leadership.
He says different work cultures take time to adapt to. The executive director of the Fiji Women's Rights Movement says the impact of militarism on Fiji society has been profound. Nalini Singh talks about Fiji's strong laws and policies against violence, sexual violence and rape, protecting the rights of women and children being ineffective in cutting incident levels.
One of the reasons we think is a real issue is this culture of hypermasculinity displayed in our communities by men. And one of the things that we think leads to it is this culture of acting with absolute impunity by our military. We know that there needs to be a separation of the state and the arm of the military.
Johnny Kalauniwai agrees the impact on Fiji is apparent and says for soldiers returning from deployment, it can be a difficult adjustment. Mr. Kalauniwai says during periods in recent years, a third of the military has been deployed as UN peacekeepers, and they've seen how it's affected them.
It has brought in those positive and negative impacts on the families. In most cases, we've had families that have virtually broken up in terms of marriages. Children have lost their fathers, families have lost their loved ones.
56 Fijians have died while serving as UN peacekeepers. Mr. Kalauniwai says the communal village setting of Fiji helps soldiers reintegrate on return, but he says the military also tries to play a part.
In terms of getting them under a counselling program and trying to assist them in terms of seeing that they maintain their families and that they come back and are able to go back into society and to their families.
Despite laws and programs to protect the vulnerable, figures of domestic and sexual violence in the country do not look set to change. However, in the election later this year, the country has the option to choose a differing role for the military. This is Dominic Godfrey.
A UN grant has helped two Samoan women to get their eco-friendly feminine pads for women menstruation cycles to the market sooner. The reusable product lasts up to 2 years and offers more affordable alternatives solution for the women's menstrual cycle. The pair launched their products on World Menstrual Day. Sarah Tviatulu has more.
On average, a woman uses 50 pads during her lifetime, and one pad takes hundreds of years to fully biodegrade. But often taboos surrounding periods, combined with the absence of female decision makers in business, has been a hindrance to development. In Samoa, sanitary care is expensive, especially for many women on low incomes or based in rural areas like the island of Savai'i. The founders of Mana Care, Isabel Rash and Angelica Salile Sefo, who both work for the Secretariat of the Pacific Community in Apia, were motivated to address the problem. So they designed a pad-type product made of a special fabric that lasts for up to 2 years and can be reused and washed, making it more user-friendly to the environment. Both say women should feel empowered to be able to discuss periods openly, as it indicates fertility and is something to be thankful for and celebrated. In this age of one-time use plastic products, Ms. Rash says it was a priority to find a more eco-friendly solution that people could afford, and thanks to an environment grant, they were able to open for business sooner.
Demand has already kicked off, so we were in a recruiting process, and because like we said, this is a business owned by two Samoan women, and we want to get back to not only empowering of Samoan people, but Samoan women.
Ms. Rash says their project was the only one selected from the Pacific and the Asia-Pacific region as one of just 12 winners in a UN environment competition. Each winner received $10,000, which Manukau used for design, buying special fabric and hiring staff. UN Programme Officer Janet Salem says their initiative was a great fit. She says the competition's aim was to find innovative ways to make sustainable lifestyles easier in Asia and the Pacific.
It's actually giving consumers access to female hygiene products sometimes for the first time. And that's, I think, something that Angelica and Isabella feel really strongly about. They're going to ensure that the product is available to low-income consumers who were either using unhygienic methods or they weren't using sort of much at all, and it was preventing them from interacting socially while they had their periods every month.
Ms. Salem says the fact that their product absorbs what it needs to and can be washed and dried in the sun and then reused just makes feminine care more accessible. Plus, the pads look nice. The carbon footprint from making female hygiene products is enormous, and despite it being a multi-billion industry, female hygiene has seen few innovations over 80 years.
We carbon footprinted each pad, the plastic pads versus the cotton pads, and the plastic ones add up to about 3.5 kilos of carbon footprint even. They contribute to climate as well. So you can also have a climate change reduction, and obviously the waste management, you know, for small Pacific islands.
Ms. Rash says they already have plans to develop and one day make reusable nappies and wipes.
And we hope to continue in an exclusive business, such as which can contribute to low-income communities. But we also want to carry out campaigns that target schools and victim supports and women's prisons, for example. And then maybe we soon, probably with the next 2 months, we hope to conduct our first rural pop-up shop, and we're hoping to take this out to Savaii.
She says currently their pad pack costs 70 tala or $27, which includes two liners, two regular pads and two overnight pads. But each product can also be purchased individually.
One of the most prolific writers in New Zealand has produced an account of crafty schemers in the early days of the European settlement in the region. Former academic John Dunmore has written extensively on the Pacific, and his latest book, which is on sale this week, Scoundrels and Eccentrics of the Pacific, chronicles the lives of some people who sought to benefit from the discoveries of the early explorers. Don Wiseman spoke to the 94-year-old Dr. Dunmore about several of the characters he has drawn portraits of. He began by asking about Charles de Rais, a French aristocrat who aimed to establish a settlement he called New France in the islands just off Papua New Guinea's mainland.
The Pacific was for centuries totally unknown to Europeans and indeed to Asians. A lot of people didn't believe it existed even. And when it was sort of revealed, discovered, explored, people began to consider the possibilities of making a living out of it or making a profit or making a deal. And Charles de Rais was one of those who had an idea how about making a settlement and becoming the chief of it and king of it. He was a French aristocrat whose family had not done very well because of the French Revolution, and he thought they might possibly create something, but it turned out to be a dream, and it turned out to be a racket.
It was worse than a dream, wasn't it? It was a horror with hundreds of people dying. Essentially a Ponzi scheme, the Pacific's first Ponzi scheme.
Well, that's right. You can buy some land, create an estate, and become a landlord, a large-scale ranch owner, farmer, this country, so you buy it and you go out. Eventually an expedition goes out, but in fact there's nothing there. So you have a series of shipwrecks, illness, ruin, and as you say, death.
Did Charles de Rais ever come to the Pacific?
Good heavens, no.
Why? Because he recognised that it was all a bit of a rort or too much like hard work?
Well, he sort of thought it possibly might have worked and made a profit and so forth, and then he would have come out. But in reality, the reports he got back, disastrous. Yeah. And eventually settlements were organised in very small way, but they gave up in time.
So New France never joined New Britain and New Ireland out there.
No.
Blackbirding has long been something that we haven't really known that much about, but one of the people that was involved that you mention in this book, the American James Proctor, he seemed like a particularly nasty piece of work.
Well, blackbirding is really recruiting unwilling people for slave work. It's really collecting slaves and sending them to work on plantations or places either in other parts of the Pacific or in places like Peru and so forth, South America. And how do you recruit these people? Well, unscrupulous ones would cheat.
And how did he cheat? He had a particular advantage, didn't he?
Yeah, and really, you know, in fact, it's kidnapping in various ways. Once you've got a number of people on board, you sort of imprison them and you sail off and you land them all as slave workers, really.
Yes, he trapped them into getting on board his boats by, well, he had a...
This particular character had a wooden leg which was needed because he'd lost one of his legs, and the wooden leg could be unscrewed. So he fascinating the islanders that he visited by showing them how he could take off his leg and wave it about. And he got them to come on board his ship to see this demonstration of this great magician who could take his leg off and wave it about. And while he was doing this on board ship and they were looking at him, the crew just untied the ship and sailed away with them. And then crew came down with guns and locked up the islanders who were there and took them off to islands or places where they were turned into slaves.
Yes. We know that there were something like, I think, 70,000 people across the Pacific who were blackbirded. How many do you think James Proctor was responsible for?
Numbers are very difficult to record. It's not something that he wanted to publicise too much. He was really making money, like other blackbirders, by sailing around the Pacific from one island to another.
Someone who maybe doesn't qualify as a scoundrel, but certainly someone who had a fascinating life, was Queen Emma of Papua New Guinea, also Queen Emma of Samoa. Very interesting character.
Yes, she was a very attractive, strong personality, and she married or got involved with important people, and she was very useful as a personality in developing some of these kingdoms, native kingdoms, really. And she was so well dressed, so well presented, that she attracted people who were artists and drew very attractive pictures of her as queen.
Yes, her prime objective, though, it seemed, was to make lots of money, and she managed that for most of her life.
The aim of all these scoundrels is to make money in some way, and unscrupulous in many ways, but she was building up money, but status and situation at the same time. And it's very nice to call herself queen.
She got dubbed that, didn't she? Was that an irony or not?
No, in a way, but quietly.
She was quite happy with it.
Yes, very indeed.
And then died a quiet life in Monte Carlo.
Well, this is the thing, that she eventually had to get out of the way, and she did plan to go back to Europe, and her partner was in Monte Carlo, and she went to Monte Carlo eventually and died there, which sounds a very nice way of ending a scoundrelish kind of life.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. We'll see you again very soon. Just a reminder, we have a program that goes out 3 times daily. We'll see you again. Bye-bye.